This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we open the phone lines for questions about computers. This is our monthly Computers and You program. Your telephone calls about computers are invited. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Two guests join us this month to answer our questions. Both of them are with sites at the University of Illinois, the Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services Unit here at the U of I. Our guests are Debbie Flieger and Jim Eyrick. Debbie is a network engineer. Jim is a wireless network designer. And we can take any kind of questions you have this afternoon about computers. Join us with a phone call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we've already got a listener who's coming in on line four, so let's go ahead and take this call right away.
Sounds good.
All right. Line four, good afternoon. You're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon. Yeah, I was wondering, I'm having problems with my laptop. I got one of those, I think they're antiquated. I don't know. It just takes forever to get started up. But and this is just, you know, not basically plugged in. It's battery operated, of course. And my problem is, actually, it's my wife's. I want to get her another one, but we were looking at repairing this one or buying a new one. And it seems like it's going to come down to buying a new one because we've had it worked on several times, and it just takes forever to load. So my question is, what kind of a laptop do you recommend, or what brand, like a Sony or a Dell or something? I don't know. She's got a Sony now, but the thing is so damn slow. I was just calling in to ask you that and see if you recommend any ideas on them.
Well, if I jumped in, I'd say a Mac, but that's because I mostly use Macs. And if you're looking at Sonys, you probably want a Windows machine. Jim, what's your experience with different flavors?
Mostly, I've only owned Dells, just because a lot of the places I work, that's what they buy. But I think really, if you just go with a name brand, Toshiba, Sony, Dell, HP, you're not gonna. And you like the options it has on it and the price point and things, I think that any of them are going to be able to satisfy you.
Yeah, I'd definitely look for something with the features that you want. It's going to have a CD-ROM drive these days, or if she doesn't need one of the little netbooks, figure out what you need in terms of screen real estate, how big your screen needs to be, what kind of connectors you need on it. If you've got an old parallel printer, how are you going to hook that up? Those kinds of things. But other than that, what price fits your budget, and somebody with a warranty.
Oh, definitely. Okay. Warranty, especially on laptops. And the other thing, so if you're looking at a Windows machine, Windows 7.0 is getting some of the people already are getting them. Manufacturers will start shipping machines with them soon. So if that's something that interests you, you might look at a machine that either has Windows 7.0 on it or has something that says, hey, when it comes out and for our machines and we have all our drivers ready for it, you can get a free CD to install on it.
Okay, very good. What's the lifetime operation? What's the life of a laptop like these days? How many years can you expect it to be going strong with you?
Well, it really depends on how much you want it to be a laptop. I mean, I've got a PowerBook 3400 sitting on my desk at home that I use to do some, small ancillary stuff that's got to be 15 years old, but I can't unplug it. So the battery life has a whole lot to do with how useful it is as a laptop.
Right, and the batteries last about 3 years, you get less than 50% of their original runtime out of those lithium batteries for laptops, and they just age. The batteries go bad. You can get replacement batteries, but sometimes after 3 or 4 years, the battery cost of the replacing it is so much, you're like, maybe I should just get the new processor with more memory and the new versions of the software. Typically, I think a laptop should last 3 to 4 years.
That's getting a good life out of it. It also depends on what your needs are, though. If you're just doing word processing and email, you can get away with a lot slower computer than if you need to do visualization software or run AutoCAD or, you know, or something in between there, and or really fancy spreadsheets and high-end calculations. You know, you can get away with an older machine with a newer battery.
Yeah. What do you think of the mini notebooks?
I think they have their place. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'd want to write term papers on one. Unless I had it plugged into a large monitor and an external keyboard and a mouse.
Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, it's great for reading email, surfing the web, simple things. I mean, I wouldn't mind writing papers on it if I just had a text paper. If I needed to do, you know, fancy layout and if I needed to do graphics and stuff, I wouldn't want to use one.
But it's really portable, though.
My fat fingers don't like the little keyboard so much.
Yeah.
It depends on the brand. Some of them are better than others. Debbie and I have both looked at a couple different ones for various projects, and they're definitely some of the models that excel compared to the other ones.
And, you know, price for performance are pretty impressive. I mean, it's a pretty fully featured computer for, you know, $250, $350. If the small form factor works for you or if you can plug it into an external monitor most of the time, it's a great deal.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking about computers this afternoon. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 if you've got a question about computers. No one's waiting at the moment. Debbie, when you came in, you had mentioned that you had seen something pop up on your computer that was trying to scare you into buying something.
Yeah, it's, I think, relatively new, right, Jim? The last few months.
Some of the antivirus ones have been around for a while, that your machine's infected kind of stuff, but I think they're getting more sophisticated.
Yeah, I went to, you know, I did a Google search and I clicked on one of the links returned by Google so that, you know, in the top few, maybe top page or so, and, you know, it just said, your machine's infected. Here, download our product. And I said no, because, I mean, I could see, I'm sitting at a Mac, in a Mac web browser, and it's saying, you know, you've got all these viruses. I'm like, this is really unlikely. I probably don't. Even if I do, I can run my own antivirus, and it won't hurt me. I'll just get rid of them before I accidentally infect somebody who's got a Windows machine. And then it said, and when I said no, it popped up another screen and said, here, we're going to check for viruses now. And it popped up a window in my browser that said, wow, I'm finding all these viruses. And it showed the scan bar and showed a layout of Internet Explorer with Windows icons and Windows folders. And I'm like, you guys are pulling a fast one on me, because there's no way suddenly I'm running Windows. I mean, I've got virtual Windows software on, but it wasn't turned on. So, yeah, it's a nickname of Scareware. And what they wanted me to do was download their little program to take all those viruses off my computer. And I did a little bit of reading about them, and they said typically either you get viruses or malware by downloading it, or you pay them to get it, or both. So don't believe everything you see on the Internet. Yeah. If it pops up and says, oh, my gosh, you're infected, and it's not the program you installed, they may be trying to...
That's really low.
It is.
There's I think we've had some previous callers called in about some of those ones that are – they're called like Antivirus 2009 and things like that. So, yeah.
Let the buyer beware.
My recommendation is to download, if you're on a Windows machine, SpyBot, Search and Destroy, get all the updates and run a full run on your machine. And if you start getting – Debbie, obviously just some of the new pop-ups, I think, is that they found new ways to get around the pop-up blockers that are part of our browsers. So most of us that are not used to seeing pop-ups have seen some in the last couple of weeks. Some people – if you have pop-ups and you haven't seen any lately, it's possible that you actually did get infected, because these little malware things that get installed will start doing pop-ups on your screen. So then I still recommend that you go and get SpyBot, even if you think it was just from a web page.
Okay.
Just to run it once and to make sure that it doesn't come up and say you have something serious.
Okay.
But you should download it from a place you trust. You shouldn't believe little links that pop up on your machine.
Certainly. That's absolutely true.
Okay. We've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. Next, we go and take a call from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
I have a question. I have a wireless router at home, and there's a lot of different options for security to set up the wireless. Like, and which one should I be looking at? Some are like WPA, WPA2, or just WEP. It's a little confusing, and it's not clear to me which one I should try to use. I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the call.
So those are all three different security protocols that wireless routers have and access points. Their WEP was the oldest one and is easy to for people that want to break into and listen to your traffic. You should avoid that one completely. WPA was the next one, and it has its share of problems. Would I run my home network on it if that's what the only thing my laptop supported? Yeah, I wouldn't be too upset about it. WPA2 is the newest one. There is no other one better than that right now. So if you can, if your laptop and your router can both support WPA2 and with AES security, that's what you should run. And you start at WPA2, and then if your laptop or something doesn't support that, go back to WPA. And then if you have to, go to WEP and then consider buying a new wireless card and a new router.
Yeah, I mean, WEP's got its uses. It keeps it from being wide open, but if somebody wants to get in, they can. So it's better than nothing, but not by a whole lot. It keeps accidents from happening, people who accidentally get on your wireless, but it won't keep somebody who wants to be on your wireless off.
Okay, let's take another call. This listener is in Pontiac on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I'm going to be looking at an Apple laptop of some sort. I want to write a book, and I'm probably not going to buy it till next year, but I want one that's going to be particularly good, and I really want a laptop. I just don't want to, I want to be able to go where I go to do this. So you said something about working with Macs and everything. So what should I be looking for in terms of something like that, in terms of storage and stuff? That would be my main use for it.
Well, pretty much any notebook you buy new as opposed to used is going to have a hard drive of over 100 gigs these days. 80 to 100 is about the smallest you can get if you try. Most of them are going to be near 200 gigs of space. Your operating system is going to take a little bit of that, but well under 20. And that would leave you the rest of the 80 to store your book in and the programs to write your book. So storage is probably not what I'd worry about. Obviously, if you're writing a book, you want to have a backup plan, though. Make sure you back up the work you do on your hard drive. Buy an external drive. An external USB drive is, for $100 you can get a terabyte if you shop around a little bit. So there's no reason not to do that. And if it's a really serious book, you're really worried about it, put a copy off site, run it to CD every once in a while.
It won't be that serious.
Depends on how much you're worried about it. So I wouldn't worry about that. For writing, the two things I would worry about is how comfortable is the screen for you. They have glare and they have glossy and anti-glare screens. Is it big enough for you to easily read what you're working on, see anything you want to see? If you're doing reference work, if you're looking stuff up in a web browser beside the space you're writing on, is the screen big enough to hold both of those things? And then is the keyboard comfortable? If you're going to sit with it on your lap or at a table, is that comfortable for your hands? How would you want to do that? I mean, I'd worry much more about those kind of ergonomic type things for writing a book than I would about the features of the computer. Because if you're buying a new one, just about anything out there is going to run software to write a book with.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Other questions are invited this afternoon. Our guests are Debbie Flieger and Jim Eyrick. They are with SITES at the University of Illinois. SITES stands for Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a phone call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And again, no one waiting at the moment. Debbie, you mentioned ergonomics, and I think this is really important, especially with a laptop, it seems to me, you can have problems. And I've seen people using things to kind of prop up the keyboard a little bit so that what do you think about those devices? There might be something that you can buy them at a business supply store or something. They hold up the computer a little bit, so the keyboard is at an angle, which is like for a PC, that's something that you have on the back of the keyboard, these little.
Like
what do you
feet
call those
on the
feet?
Bed.
Yes, thank you.
Well, I guess there's some basic ergonomic stuff that actually comes with most computers that reminds you how you should sit and how you should have your arms. But I think for most people, they're worried about carpal tunnel in their wrists, And I think pretty much, if I'm remembering correctly, the idea is that you don't want to flex your wrists strongly one way or the other, that you want it to be mostly straight in line with your arm. And so if you don't tilt your keys up a little bit, you tend to have your arm and then your hand goes down to meet it, and depending on how you sit. And so those things can help with that. It very much depends on how you sit and how your hands are laid. If you actually put it in your lap, you set your hands flat on your lap. And of course, nobody can see me set my hands flat on my lap. But if you let your arms go straight out and your hands are right on the keys, you don't need anything like that because everything's nice and flat and nice and straight. But if you're working with it on a computer desk, you think about all the things there are to move keyboards around so that it's just right. If you're actually typing on the computer instead of attaching a USB keyboard and typing on the keyboard if you're sitting at a desk, then that would apply to what you need to do to your laptop too to help keep it from putting strain on your wrists.
Okay, so keep your arms and your wrists fairly straight.
I think there are, besides just being able to change the position, the angle of the laptop, there are the laptop rests that have fans in them, actually. So part of it is just to get the hot laptop off your legs. So that's another good thing.
It increases the life of the computer somewhat to keep it from running too hot.
Right, absolutely.
Okay, very good.
Some of the smaller laptops, depending on where the fans are, having it on your lap against your jeans or a blanket on the couch or whatever could actually impede airflow.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for the program. I have a question for your guest. My internet connection is through the traditional telephone line, and it has the high-speed multiplexing capability. But one of the members of the family also wanted to have remote access within the home, and so installed wireless port so that they could use their computer remotely. And my question is, presumably the remote portion can be hacked if you have poor quality. You were speaking of various types of levels of security. What about the wired connection that's hardwired through the phone line? Can that be hacked through the radio frequency connection? Have I made my query sufficiently complicated?
Well, I think I'm a little unclear. When you say they've got a remote wireless port, did they add a wireless access point so they could sit in the other room and use it?
When
you say, okay. If somebody can get onto the wireless because that you don't have security turned on the wireless, then they can get through to the wired part and then on out to your internet connection.
So
the wireless basically extends the wires. There, once you're on the wireless, and generally there'll be no difference between being plugged in with a cable.
Okay, so both are vulnerable then.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Let's take a call next from a listener in Muhammad, line two. Good afternoon.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. You had mentioned earlier the SpyBot search and destroy, and I think I've been told AdAware is another one that I should run periodically. When you run those programs and it brings up a list of items, I guess, that it finds, I've been told you don't want to necessarily delete everything that it finds. How do you determine what to get rid of and what not to?
That can be a tough one. I think it requires that you'll actually have a little bit of knowledge of what stuff you've done on your computer. There are certainly, and SpyBot even brings this up when you run it the first time. It says, or actually every time unless you checkmark the box that says don't, it tells you that by deleting certain things, you may cause ad-based software programs not to run. In general, these are usually games. So I think what you'd have to do is have a familiarity with what you're actually using if you're using ad-based software or ad-supported software in your computer, and then make sure to not get rid of that stuff. Because basically you're agreeing to provide information about yourself or about your computer habits to the manufacturer or the sponsor of that software, and they then agree that for that information they will trade you and let you run a piece of software that normally you'd have to pay for. So unless you know that you don't use those, which in general I don't, so when I run SpyBot Search and Destroy, I tell it to remove everything, then you actually need to know what you're using before you can just say wipe out all the settings that SpyBot finds.
So that's mostly on games that have been downloaded then, typically?
That's normally where I see those things is ad-supported games. I don't know if Debbie has an experience with other. She's shaking.
No, not really.
Yeah. No, that games is normally where I see that stuff. I'm not saying that there's not other things out there, but when I've been asked to come clean somebody's computer and it has what SpyBot or AdAware's or LavaSoft's AdAware call it as spyware, it's usually because somebody downloaded a game and they actually agreed to have that spyware installed on the machine as part of the license to play that game.
Okay. That makes sense. So if I'm not worried about anything that we've downloaded as far as games, then I should be able to clean it all off.
Yes. Now, it's important, and SpyBot suggests you do this when you install, and I think every time you install an update, a major update, is that you make a backup of your registry before you make any changes. That way, in case it does remove something that's very important to you, that you can restore that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener. Oh, they're gone. So I will invite others to join us this afternoon. No one waiting at the moment. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, one of the things that we talked about, we could talk about if there was a little bit of a lull, domain names and email.
Certainly. So Debbie and I both have personal email addresses that end in, is yours flygr.net and mine is iric.com. So our last names and .net and .com. I also own iric.net. And that way I never have to change my email address, basically. I have moved across country. I have changed internet or...
So your ISP
doesn't
matter?
Doesn't matter. I'm not even sure that if Comcast sent me an email that if they sent it to the whatever my account is at Comcast, that I would actually get it. Which could be bad. I try to make sure that my ISP's email is at least forwarded to me so when they have outages and things, they can let me know. But otherwise, it doesn't matter. I could switch every other day and my email would be unaffected.
And it used to be a little bit difficult to do this. It was fairly easy to buy the domain, but then you had to run a server to get the mail. And one of the things that's gotten really easy to do in the last year or so is for very little money or even free, find somebody that would host the mail for you. So you do buy the domains from a domain registrar. There's a handful of different places you can go to do that. But then there's a few places that you can say, okay, now that I've got my domain, I want you to run my email for me. And they'll just do it. And you know, your email gets delivered to their server and you pull it down from that and you work out with them, you know, usually just through a web interface, how you want that handled. And that's the biggest difference recently is in the last couple of years. You can, instead of having to then not only buy your domain name, then have a box that you ran yourself to get your mail and, you know, have your ISP deliver your mail and all that stuff.
Or pay more than most people were willing to pay.
You know, to have somebody else do it for you,
right.
So you said Google's doing this now?
So Google, it's called Google Apps. Will let you set up some settings with them with the people that you have host your domain name, and then Google let you run email at your domain name. So Google Apps is actually running iric.com.
So how do we find a host for a domain name?
I just went to Google and typed domain name hosting and lots of options came up. I think the actual first name was GoDaddy. Is the first one.
It's a popular one.
Network Solutions, which is the original one, still does stuff. I personally use a company called Pair, PAIR.com. I've been with them for years and have had luck. I have friends with GoDaddy.
I'm on Joker.com. There are lots of different places that can sell you domain names.
So you need to find one that will sell you a domain name and possibly provide DNS service for you.
That's what lets the computers look up your name and turn it into which computer to go see.
Which would tell them to actually point to, like, Google servers for your mail. And Google actually help you set that up. They have instructions on, okay, you need to have this setting set in your DNS settings.
There's some recipes you can follow.
Certainly. That's what I was getting to.
Okay.
It's not that you need to understand every bit of what Google's asking
you to do.
But yeah, they have and checklists. There are forums and things that you could go to Google for and people will help you say, okay, you need to do this. If you're with GoDaddy, this is how you do it. If you're with – and actually I believe Google Apps has these instructions. You tell them who has your domain name. And they'll actually tell you what web page to go to, click here, put this information here kind of stuff. So they've built a lot of the recipes because they certainly want people to do this. And now we talked about this being a free service. Talk something about you're making a trade.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Google gets to learn things about you, and that's what they do, so that they can then market advertising targeted specifically to you, and the more they know about you, the better they can do that, which may not actually be a bad thing. If somebody can figure out exactly what I want today and they can show me that advertisement, it's good for them and me, maybe. Maybe not good for my wallet.
Okay. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a Linksys wireless router that I can access through my computer, type in the 192.168 routine, but it quit accepting that IP number. What do I do?
What'd you change?
That's a good question. I wish I knew. as far as I know, nothing. I mean, I haven't been into the router for months. And, in fact, I kind of had to look up the IP number and to type in, and I did that, and it won't access the router. Should I reset the router?
Well, I would. Well, have you power cycled it? Not actually reset. Okay, and that didn't help.
Right.
Your computer can still surf the internet through the router. Okay. So, what IP address is your computer being assigned?
Well, I can find it easily. I'm not in front of the computer.
Okay. So on Linksys or almost all home routers. Is whatever the gateway is that your computer is using, whatever the setting, if you go to your computer and on a Windows machine, you type /ipconfig/all, and there's a gateway option. That will be the IP address that router answers to for its management interface. Now, if for some reason you type the gateway in and your computer still says, or you can't get to it, there might be some stuff in your computer that's messing that up, something in Internet Explorer, some host record that's messing stuff up. But it's possible that just the router's malfunctioning. And the first thing certainly would be to try a reset.
Okay.
I think.
If I reset it, am I going to have to redo the security options and so on?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Which is why I would start with the other things first.
Right.
Yes, so reboot it, which you already did, and then try using the IP address that your computer's getting for Gateway in your web browser to connect to the Linksys router instead of the 192.168 address. And if
okay,
both of
how
the,
would I find that IP address on a Mac?
Ifconfig, isn't it?
Ifconfig -a will do it. You can also go into System Preferences and click on Network. Are you on Mac OS 10 or?
Yes.
Okay. It changed a little bit between 10.4 and 10.5. In 10.4, if you bring it up, it'll just show it to you right as soon as you go into Network Preferences. If you're in 10.5, it'll show you the one you're connected on. There's a little button marked Advanced, and if you click on that, you get a whole bunch of choices across the top, one of which is TCP/IP. And then eventually you'll get to a screen that says what your IP address is and what your subnet mask is and what your router is. And the router address would be what you'd want for your gateway address to try to put that in the web.
All right. Well, I'll see if I can hunt it down. Thank you.
Good luck. Next we take a call from a listener waiting on line two. And good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hi.
Hi.
This is more of a general web surfing question rather than a hardware question, that kind of thing. I'm wondering, how do you find, if you're wanting some advice on any specific consumer product or service or something, something that involves spending money, how do you select or find any kind of a site that has information that hasn't been placed there by somebody wanting you to do something specific, like spend money on their product or their service? I mean, some neutral place where you can get some advice on stuff like that.
It certainly seems to be harder nowadays than it used to be. The first thing I do really honestly is I try to put the product name or actually if I know exactly the model number in a search engine and with the word review after it, and I look to see. And you will have to sort through a lot to get past the websites that are trying to sell one to you or sell competitors to you. But you'll find if it's computer product, I think the CNET web pages, you'll find reviews there.
Where's that? I missed that.
It's CNET.
CNET,
CNET. I'm not sure, again, if it's .com or .net. .com. They have it's actually reviews.cnet.com.
Okay.
Otherwise, you just surf through them and find it. Another idea is to try to find, for me, I try to find forums.
And I would say that depends on what kind of thing you're looking for. One of the places I go is consumerreports.org. Just like their paper magazine, they have an online version. Part of it's free to access. Part of it you have to subscribe to get some of the in-depth stuff.
Okay.
And, you know, and it's a lot like going to their magazines. You know, just like they say, you know, we don't buy ads, right? There are discussion forums where people get together and chat about stuff. And so if you can find one on the style of thing you're looking for, and people sometimes do impromptu reviews. I actually, if I'm stuck, sometimes I go to Amazon. Because a lot of people will post reviews. Now, you got to be careful which one's the review by the publisher, if it's a book or a CD. But, you know, individuals will post review, and you can usually tell if they're getting something out of it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not always easy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, great. Thanks for the suggestion.
The vendors have been getting more complicated about how they – I think it's shady, and they get caught once in a while. But it's still – it's kind of tough to find legitimate ones.
Yeah, sometimes you can get a fairly good idea – if you go to a website and you click on About, you can kind of get an idea of who's behind this and, you know, what they're all about, you know, what kind of review process they have. And from time to time, the big online newspapers, well, actually probably daily, they have technology reviews and reports as well. And sometimes they have opportunities for you to write in with a query. Online, so another possibility.
I think for non-technical stuff, I think that some of the best would be the forums. I mean, I don't know if you were buying an electric drill, if any newspapers have reviewed an electrical drill lately, but I bet there's a forum out there that if you were buying a brand name electrical drill, somebody talked about it and said whether they had a good time or bad time with it.
Yeah, that's true. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon are Jim Irick and Debbie Flieger there with the University of Illinois. We're there with Sites, Campus Information Technologies, and Educational Services. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, this is a program we call Computers and You. We do it once a month, usually on the third Monday of the month. And it's an opportunity for you to call in and have your questions about computers answered. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting for us now in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Yes, hello. I wanted to ask a question sort of along the lines of, I guess, what a lot of people have been asking in this hour about wireless routers. The question, I guess, again, is about security, and this time I'm interested, I guess, in knowing a little bit more about Mac address control. I recently actually changed, I added a wireless internet or wireless Ethernet bridge, and for reasons of compatibility, I took off my security and didn't broadcast the SSID. And to make it secure, I guess I just put on MAC address control to the computers and devices I want to be able to use that. My question, I suppose, is the way that is currently functioning, is that safe? You know, I guess no one knows the SSID, and you know, I'm only adding the MAC addresses I want.
Well, except just because you didn't tell it to broadcast, that just means people who are playing nice don't see it. I can start up a free wireless sniffer, and I can see it in a heartbeat.
Okay.
And so can anybody else. And as soon as they see one packet go from your computer to your SSID on one of those free wireless sniffers, they know your MAC address.
Okay.
So it is basically wide open to anybody who wants to be mean. You're absolutely protected from people who accidentally use your wireless.
Right, just like you said with the WEP.
Exactly, except this is a little easier to get through.
Okay, so
Much
easier to get through. WEP would be better than this in
general. Okay, so I wasn't aware that you could just sort of pick up the SSID from traffic.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I suppose I will change my configuration.
I would highly recommend it. And then once you're running WPA2, I don't worry about MAC filtering, personally. I don't know if Debbie has that set up on her house at home.
Well, no. I live out in the country. I use WEP.
Oh, nice.
But I've got some old gear that doesn't do WPA.
Right.
I would use WPA2 if I had all my gear could do it.
Okay. Let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone, line two. Hi.
Hi. Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Not bad for a man of my age.
Okay.
I have a question about a laptop in conjunction with a tabletop monitor. Can I hook up just an LCD monitor to my laptop without a docking station?
If your laptop has video output.
It does.
Then there should not be any issues. As long as the two devices have matching, you know, your laptop has a matching output and your LCD monitor has a matching input, then
it should just work.
You should just work.
We'll try it.
Thanks. You're welcome. Another caller waiting for us in moments on line 3. Hi.
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 I got a question about VPN, and I've got a problem that just occurred with my VPN, and I have no idea what's going on, but I think I have a clue. I understand that some of the ISPs have decided to take it upon themselves to do DNS interruptions, and DNS, they're messing with the DNS somewhere if it's a secondary call, and I wonder if that's why my VPN has stopped working. Could it be that?
Some ISPs have also decided that for somebody working at home that considers their internet connection residential, to just not allow VPN to work too. So
right.
it could be worse. It depends on what VPN technology, what brand of VPN basically you're using. There are some of them that are better at getting around that than others.
Yeah.
Regarding DNS, you can always point your machine at a third-party DNS server. So you can search on the internet and just search for public DNS servers, and you could try to point at other DNS servers besides your ISPs.
Okay. All right. I'll give it a try. Thank you.
Okay. A listener in Urbana waits for us next on line 1. Hello.
Hello. I have an old G4, and then I bought a new Intel Core Duo Mac, and I was wondering, can I put everything from the G4 into the new computer by just hooking up some wire or something?
Well, the first thing to figure out is what you mean by everything. You can move all your user data pretty easily. Applications are a little trickier. There's some built-in software in the Mac OS that will try and move them for you. And it will get most of them and most of their parts, but some applications are tricky and put things not quite where Apple said they ought to be. And it, you know, so most of them will work, but you'll want to test each one. In the new Mac, there in the utilities directory, there's going to be something called Apple Migration Helper, and that'll help you. It'll step you through what you want to move. If you want to move your user directories or your applications or both or your network settings, and all you need for that is either an Ethernet cable, because you can do it over the network. But the better way to do it, from the Mac's point of view, and it works with more platforms and operating systems, is with a FireWire cable. And you boot one of them into target disk mode, and it has instructions step-by-step of how to do this. And it basically just looks like a hard drive attached to your new computer, and your new computer reads that data in for you.
Oh, okay. I have one other question quick. It's, I put a bunch of stuff in the trash in my new computer accidentally. For my Aperture photo library,
mm-hmm.
and I'm looking for it, but there's a lot of stuff, and I wonder, can you selectively throw stuff out of the trash when you're in trash? You know, I've got all these things in trash.
If you're in the trash, and the trash is open, and you click on a specific item, and you say delete that item, I believe it removes it from the trash.
Okay.
One item at a time.
One item at a time. All right, because I was trying to get rid of stuff, and I want to, without getting rid of the stuff that I might want to get back. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to join us this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine with a question about computers. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We've got about 6 minutes left in this portion of the program. No one's waiting on the phone at the moment. Are there tools available that would help me manage email? And in terms of when it's coming in, can I, from the get-go, have the email that I'm most interested in receiving come in with some kind of a priority or go into a special place? Any ideas?
Well, that usually depends on the software you're using to read your email.
Okay.
So in Apple Mail, absolutely, I could tell you how to do it.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure Thunderbird probably has some kind of sorting or filtering.
Yes. I would expect that any graphic email program, and even the non-graphic ones, have some sort of filter process that can be used to highlight things or to somehow make them, put them where you want them to be, that you're considering them more important than others. The question is how you define that,
yeah.
Whether it's from a certain person, comes in at a certain time of day, has a certain subject. That's the difficulty in defining those filters.
So I just need to spend a little time and investigate that.
I think you need to decide how. I think you'd have to start with what are your rules for it's an important email,
mm-hmm.
and then think if you can define those in a way that your email program's filter would understand.
Most of them are going to be able to do it by who sent it or who it was to. Like, so you might do something different if it came to you directly versus to a mailing list and your name's not in the to field, or you know what the subject is. If there's certain subjects you,
mm-hmm.
you know people are going to send you mail with this
mm-hmm.
title, you know, put those in the certain things. Those kind of things almost every program is going to be able to do. There's fancier things like by time of day or things like that some things will do and some things won't do.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Carlock on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
So my question is basically, should I do something myself or should I take it to somebody else to get my computer fixed? I'm fairly literate, but not an expert by any means. But essentially what my problem is when I boot up, if I just boot up normally, I get a blue screen and an error message that says something like hard disk error and a number. And I Google that number, and it seems to be a registry problem. And I don't know how it happened, whether it was a virus or what, but I can boot up in safe mode and use the Internet and what have you, but I've lost some functionality. I can play video but not hear the sound, for instance, and my printer's disappeared, for instance. So I want to get it fixed, and I've talked to a few people that said I could do I could fix the registry problem myself, but it sounded so complicated, I'm not sure I want to do it. I just was looking for some advice.
It's tough ones by just without actually sitting in front of the machine sometimes. I don't think you'll hurt anything by just trying to do the registry. I would, from safe mode, if possible, I'd probably back up any important files that you have on the machine and just get them off the machine in case something blows up.
Sure.
You could try doing a from the Windows installation disk, doing a repair. That's actually part of this. If you boot up a Windows installation CD on a machine that already has Windows, if the hard drive's okay and the partitions are all there and things, Windows, the setup will actually identify that you have a previous copy of Windows installed on the machine, and it'll ask you, would you like to try to repair this?
Right.
You could go ahead and try that and see what happens. Unless you're concerned that you're going to mess something up and lose data, which in that case, like I said, back it up first, or there's some program installed that you don't think you're going to be able to get installed back on yourself, I don't see a lot of harm in trying to fix it yourself, except for just the time investment. I don't think you'll make it any – usually – or make in this case, I don't think you'll make it any worse for somebody else to fix after it doesn't go well. The worst case is you'll reinstall Windows.
Sure. Well, and I guess this is the second part of my question real quickly is when I bought the machine, it's been like 2 years ago now, they had XP on it, but it included a free upgrade to Vista, which I never did. So I guess my question would be, just if I went ahead and switched to Vista, back up all my data and load Vista, would that solve my problem? Or do I still have this problem to deal with?
I've never tried to upgrade a machine that had a bad registry on it to a new operating system. I suspect that the Vista setup file would try to import the old stuff and just throw away anything that was bad. So my guess off the top of my head was that it would work. Again, you may lose settings that a part of the registry – obviously part of the registry is corrupt. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a problem anyway. So the data – that anything that was in the data in the registry is possibly lost anyway.
Yeah.
So – you're probably not going to hurt much trying to upgrade to Vista either. I think that would probably work as well as doing the repair.
So the only thing that I might lose is those programs that I've loaded that maybe I don't have the disk for anymore, or I paid for on a one-time use or whatever. But I can, I mean, obviously I can back up all my data.
Right.
You know, all my files and what have you. So, okay, well, that helps. At least maybe I'll take the plunge and try it and see what happens. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the call this afternoon. We're out of time. Took a lot of calls, helped a lot of people. Thank you to the two of you, and we'll see you in October. Is that correct? How about that?
That sounds right to me.
Okay, third Monday in October. Debbie and Jim will be back with us next month in September. Peter Kimball will be with us here on Computers and You, our monthly program here on the Afternoon Magazine about computers. And our thanks this afternoon to Jim Irick and Debbie Flieger. They're with Sites here at the University of Illinois.